Well, it's difficult to express how comforting one of the lines towards the end of that last song is. Truths unchanged from the dawn of time, echoing down through eternity. And it's encouraging and comforting for me as we approach the scriptures this morning that there's no expectation to bring something new, but to merely proclaim the truths of old. As you noticed in the reading this morning, we looked at Exodus chapter 1 several weeks back. When we looked, we're still looking at the attributes. It wasn't very clear, and intentionally so on my part, that we were coming to an abrupt end of that series, which means that this morning, it doesn't necessarily mean that this morning we're beginning something new, but we are beginning a trek together through the book of Exodus. And so we will jump right into that together this morning. And it fits very well. Some of you will remember in the midst of the attributes series, I mentioned several times as we were looking at so many wonderful passages concerning the attributes of God from the book of Exodus, that if I would have thought about it long enough and hard enough beforehand, I would have just preached the attributes from the book of Exodus. I think we could do that sufficiently, considering that within the book of Exodus, God is continually revealing himself to his people through signs and through wonders, making clear his sovereign majesty and his holiness and his power and his awesome glory and his righteousness and his compassion. We're going to look at Exodus and see the attributes that we saw over the past 6 months or so displayed in real history. We're looking at a historical book where God has displayed himself to his people. And what he has revealed about himself so clearly, or the way that he's revealed himself so wonderfully in the book of Exodus, is through his law. Many of you are familiar with the Ten Commandments, and this is the book where they're found in chapter 20. But rather than running straight to chapter 20, we're going to take a quick jog before we get there and look at his law. And I hope that we will see the law of God as a needle that pierces a cloth, and so there's some effect, but it's dragging behind it gospel thread. That's what the law is for, and I hope that that's what it will be beneficial for us as we look at it. The focus of the entire book of Exodus is the relationship between God and his people, a covenant relationship that God has made with his people. Exodus has often been called, and rightly so, the gospel of the Old Testament. The book of Exodus holds significant hope for the whole of the human race. It offers every captive in every land of every age the hope of freedom. Most familiar to us would be the African-American slave in the mid-1800s. They were very well aware of Exodus and understood the hope that was contained here. Listen to the words of this song. When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. This is familiar to some of you, an old Negro spiritual. Thus spoke the Lord, bold Moses said, let my people go. If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead. Let my people go. No more in bondage shall they toil. Let my people go. Let them come out with Egypt's spoil. Let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. And I hope the book of Exodus proves just that for a number of us. being redeemed and rescued from sin's foul bondage that grips us so often and so consistently. I want to look this morning not just at chapter 1 that we looked at in the reading, but I want to get through chapter 2 as well. In beginning with chapter 1, the first 7 verses, we have here for us really a summary of a chapter back in Genesis. When Exodus is being recorded, there's a fast forward getting caught up to present day. And we're reminded of the kind providences that God has shown to his children, to Jacob and to Joseph. We're familiar with God's dealings with his people, and we'll look more intently at those dealings in the coming weeks. Kindnesses, constant kindnesses from God were shown to his people, even in the midst of judgment. And I say in the midst of judgment intentionally. I think when we begin reading Exodus, immediately our heart goes out to these poor Israelites. I mean, many of us remember from Sunday school, one of the vivid stories is being really mad at this Pharaoh that will not let those people go. He just kept making them make bricks and work harder and attempting to kill the little baby boys. But if we back up and see in the grand scheme of things, we have to ask ourselves a few questions. How did they get to Egypt? Well, that was part of the kind providence of God. But why did they have to go? Genesis 43:1 explains it to some degree. The famine was severe in the land. Why would there be famine in the land? Where did the famine come from? Turn over with me to Psalm 105. And let's look at several verses here in the psalm to help answer that question. Where did the famine come from? Why is there famine in the land? Now, it's important for us to remember that not only was there famine in the land of the Israelites, but the famine happened in Egypt as well. Remember the story of Joseph. Joseph goes into Egypt and ends up rescuing his people or saving his people because of the wisdom, the ability to interpret the dreams that God gave him. Let's read together Psalm 105, not in its entirety, but a large portion of it. Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Sing to him. Sing praises to him. Speak of all his wonders. Glory in his holy name. Let the heart of those who seek the Lord be glad. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his face continually. Remember his wonders which he has done, his marvels and the judgments uttered by his mouth. O seed of Jacob, his servant, O sons of Jacob, his chosen ones, he is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He has remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, the covenant which he made with Abraham and his oath to Isaac. Then he confirmed it to Jacob for a statute, to Israel as an everlasting covenant, saying, to you I will give the land of Canaan as the portion of your inheritance. When they were only a few men in number, very few and strangers in it, and they wandered about from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another people, he permitted no man to oppress them, and he reproved kings for their sakes. Do not touch my anointed ones and do my prophets no harm. Notice verse 16. And he called for a famine upon the land. He broke the whole staff of bread. He sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. They afflicted his feet with fetters. He himself was laid in irons. Until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. The king sent and released him, the ruler of peoples, and set him free. He made him lord of his house and ruler over all his possessions, to imprison his princes at will, that he might teach his elders wisdom. Israel also came into Egypt. Thus Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. And he caused his people to be very fruitful, and he made them stronger than their adversaries. And we have recorded there for us in this song a wonderful reminder of the history of God caring for his people. But I want us to notice two things. Verse 16, God called for a famine upon the land. God broke the whole staff of bread. Why would there be a famine? It's not because God ran out of the ability to grant rain, producing drought that would produce a famine. It wasn't that he was short on sunshine, and so as a result, no food could grow. Why a famine? You'll be hard-pressed to find any famine happening within the Scriptures that isn't a judgment on the people of God as a result of their sin. Now, many of the circumstances that the people of God find themselves in are a direct result of Egypt's sin towards them. But not all of the reasons fall in Egypt's lap. The famine covered their homeland as well as Egypt, as I mentioned previously. Verse 24 of the psalm is a great commentary on Exodus 1:7. He caused his people to be very fruitful and made them stronger than their adversaries. But the sons of Israel, Exodus 1:7, were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Joseph died, and the whole generation with him, but not without leaving a lasting impact. They were fruitful. However, merely outpopulating the enemy was not sufficient. Egypt, to the people of God, had seemed like a promising place for them to mature into a godly nation. But it quickly grew into a place of miserable bondage, as we see in verse 8 through the end of the chapter. Terrible oppression resulted. The Pharaoh is getting worried about the growing population of these Israelites. This new king comes on the scene saying, "Joseph who? I don't know a man named Joseph that saved our entire country." And so he sets out to deal shrewdly or wisely with the people by forcing hard labor. Look at the number of times that this is mentioned, verse 11 and following. They appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they labored to build for Pharaoh storage cities. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and in all kinds of labor in the fields, all their labors, which they rigorously imposed on them. It's incredibly redundant, and part of it's the Hebrew way of speaking. Seven times here, hard labor, rigorous labor. Now, let's think about this for a moment, because it is very likely that this oppression from a wicked king is actually what solidified the purity of the people of God. Imagine if Pharaoh is just hands off and lets them live, it's quite likely that they would have blended right in to the Egyptian race. They, after all, weren't very disappointed with where they lived. The land was good. They didn't mind being in Egypt. They had grown content there. They had even gone so far as to adopt many of the local superstitions and idolatries. But that wasn't the case. The Pharaoh didn't just let them go on and blend in. But he became worried, and in the providence of God, oppressed them, and it forced affliction on them. And verse 12 says, the more they were afflicted, the more they multiplied. The hand of God is so wonderfully evident. Even in the Pharaoh's harsh dealings with the people of God, we can see God preparing a kingdom for himself. It doesn't take long for the king to realize that his wise dealings with the people is not too wise. And so he resorts then from oppression to infanticide. This wicked king is very much anti-life, clearly rejecting God's promises to his people that he will make them a great nation. Not only that, but he pays no attention at all to the covenant that God's made with Israel or the commands that God's made to Israel. Be fruitful and multiply. I will make you a great nation. The Pharaoh is absolutely oblivious to this. And even if he did know, he wouldn't care. Not in the slightest. He goes on and rejects God's plan for his people to have their own land as well, as we'll see in the coming chapters when they want to go back to the land that God has promised. He refuses to let them go until he is strongly encouraged by God. Not only is this Pharaoh anti-life, but he's very much anti-Christ. Anti what God has for his people. Not unlike another king, Herod, who was very troubled, and all Jerusalem when they found out about a real king coming on the scene. And he gathers all the chief priests and scribes together there in Matthew chapter 2, inquiring where this Messiah was going to be born, and issues an edict quite similar to this one. All of the baby boys to be killed. Well, this didn't work either. You remember from the reading here, the midwives are commanded to kill the baby boys upon birth. They don't do it. They lie, if you want to call it that, to the Pharaoh. We don't really know if they're lying or if the babies were born really that fast during that period. It's very unlikely that the Hebrew women were really giving birth that fast on a continuous basis, or it would have been ludicrous for them to have midwives in the first place. So we can see this conversation really between the midwives and Pharaoh as the joke's on Pharaoh. I mean, he's not logically thinking, and he accepts what they say. And God blesses them and gives these midwives families. Oppression didn't work. Infanticide has failed. But the dark days continue in verse 22. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. Now, up until this point, Pharaoh has done a pretty good job of keeping his sin and his intents hidden, revealed. But his sin that was once hidden is now exposed for everyone to see. Initially, it's just a command to the midwives. Now, he commanded all his people, throw the baby boys into the Nile. Sin has this tendency in all of us. What begins as hidden, not able to be seen, that happens in the dark places, in the inner recesses of our mind and our hearts, and we think it will never grow. We can see it happening in just a matter of verses here on the pages of this chapter. It eventually exposes itself, and the intent to serve self rather than Christ becomes obvious. Not only did the Pharaoh's sin grow in severity, but it grew in boldness as well. And we live in the same kind of danger if we're harboring besetting sins of beginning to think, it's not that big of a deal. No one's called checkmate yet on this sin. I'll just continue to sin boldly and more severe. And it's a dangerous place for any of us to find ourselves. Now, we looked at verses 1 through 7, and I didn't get you my specific point on that, and I'll give it to you only because it's beneficial to me when one out of every 10 sermons is actually alliterated. So I'm going to back up and tell you that 1 through 7, we're looking at five different points. The first one is the death of the dynasty Joseph died and all his generation with him. And then here, 8 through the end of the chapter, these were dark days. Oppression, infanticide, genocide, gender selective genocide even. They were dark days, no doubt. But with a change of scene, as we move into chapter 2, there's hope quickly sensed. Look with me together. Chapter 2. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son. Now, stop right there and just put yourself in that position. In the midst of the times and what's going on, you have to think they're hoping for a girl. Hoping for a girl. She bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile, and she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. Again, this is the daughter of the Pharaoh who has issued the edict that all the little boys should die. Okay? We know what's going to happen, and so it's hard for us to interject the intensity of the story at this point and what's really going on. Okay? This is the daughter of the one who has said that this little boy should die. And she's lifting up the top of the basket. You don't have to have a very good imagination. I don't. And I can imagine what we'd expect the story to read after that. She opened it. She saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Her pity was not out of stupidity. She knew it was a Hebrew. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I'll give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. The child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, "Because I drew him out of the water." So in the midst of the dark days following the death of the amazing dynasty, we have the dawn of a deliverer. Jochebed, we'll get Moses' parents' names later, Jochebed and Amram, Moses' parents, they see his beauty. And as a result of seeing the beauty of this baby, they defy the king, hide him in a closet for 3 months. When they can hide him no longer, they build a little basket, set it on the edge of the river. Pharaoh's daughter comes, rescues the baby. Moses goes back to his mom, who nurses him, raises him. He goes back to Pharaoh's daughter. That's verses 1 through 10. Now, it's crucial that we note God's remarkable orchestration of all these things. The laws that were issued, the Pharaoh who is ruling, the parents of Moses and their decision, the sister of Moses, the daughter of Pharaoh, the basket, the river, the reeds, all of these things. And God sits enthroned in the heavens doing all of his pleasure, orchestrating every single detail, controlling them all. Now, if that's the case in this story, why would you consider wasting 1 ounce of your time and energy worrying and being anxious over all of the little things that consume you? Why toss and turn all night long, reliving your day or worrying about the next week? Why? When this God who orchestrated these kinds of details is the same God who sits enthroned in the heavens, orchestrating every detail of your life. Who's in charge? Who you're running into? What your responsibilities are? What their reactions will be? God is in the heavens doing all of His pleasure, and He's orchestrating your life. And He's doing it for your own good. He knows best. William Cooper says it best in the song that we sang. God moves in a mysterious way, His wonders to perform. Why does He move in such a mysterious way? So that He might perform wonders and we can sit in awe of Him who loved us with an everlasting love. He plants His footsteps in the sea and He rides upon the storm, deep in His dark and hidden minds with never failing skill. Never, ever does He fail in what He intends to do. He fashions all His bright designs and He works His sovereign will. Not just in the large, general, broad, vague things of life. God isn't merely just controlling that the earth keeps turning, but He's controlling your life and my life and all of our coming and going, our lying down and our rising up. In this case, He was controlling the baby in a basket amidst the reeds on the side of the river. Mysterious. I mean, just think with me some of the details. Moses is put into a basket and put in the river. That's where he was supposed to go, but without the basket. You realize the danger here. Why not take him far away from the river so that it's less likely that he ends up there? If anyone other than the intended person finds him, they're going to obey the king. He's at the river. It's a quick dump, and obedience has happened. Imagine God orchestrating this. It's mysterious. That river was the grave of so many of His peers. And He's put in a basket, in an ark, if you will. And actually, the original language includes that idea. The exact term is He was put in an ark in the water. Or consider this. Moses' mom sends Miriam, his older sister, to watch what happens. Okay? Do you not want to ask Jochebed, what are you thinking? Why would you send this young girl to watch the king's daughter find him and destroy him? Why would you subject your small child to watching his little brother die that way? God moves in mysterious ways. We have to think that Jochebed and Amram knew exactly who they intended to find the baby. Again, don't you find that odd? That they would, as much as they knew how, manipulate the situation, put the baby to where he would be found. Don't you think they knew that it was the princess coming down every day to bathe in that part of the river? That's who they wanted to find? I mean, does that make sense? The person who's closest to the one who has issued the edict that the boy should die would find him? Yet, it appears, for all intents and purposes, that's exactly what Moses' mom intended. That the Pharaoh's daughter would find him. The daughter of the king who commanded that he be killed. The writer of Hebrews succinctly describes the actions of Moses' parents in this way. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and were not afraid of the king's edict. Two things. They had faith in God and they were not afraid of man. It's an amazing aspect here with the dawn of deliverance. The river and the royal house were subjected to the providence of God. And a deliverer was secured for the people of God. However, this deliverance was delayed a bit. Or the dawn was false, we might say. Let's pick up reading in verse 11. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up. Okay? We'll insert some other passages found in Scripture. When Moses turned 40 years old, it took him a while to grow up, but that's what it means. It came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw that no one was around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he said, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, the father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon today?" So they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why is it that you've left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I've been a sojourner in a foreign land." Moses, being raised in Pharaoh's house, was aware that he had been raised up for a purpose. Again, the writer of Hebrews tells us that it was by faith that Moses set out at the age of 40 to go back and to rescue his people. The problem is, when Moses sets out, he takes matters into his own hands. He trusts in his own ability. He's aware of his role, but he incorrectly understands it. And as a result of him taking matters into his own hands, when a Hebrew is fighting an Egyptian and he kills the Egyptian, he knew it wasn't right. You saw in the Scriptures, he doesn't just take justice into his own hands. He looks to the right, he looks to the left, he makes sure no one's watching. Then he kills him. Then he buries him in a shallow grave. And then the next day, when a Hebrew, he realized word is spread, when two Hebrews are fighting, he attempts to break up the fight, and they make clear that word has indeed spread. "Who are you? Are you going to kill us too, like you did the Egyptian yesterday?" They aren't impressed with Moses. They aren't convinced that Moses is there to rule over them and to lead them out of the bondage. In fact, as I've noted already, they were quite happy in bondage and had no desire to leave, at least at this point. So because Moses misunderstands what God has called him to do, takes matters into his own hands, it's already been a 40-year delay. And another 40 years is tacked on to that as he goes in to Midian. And it appears at the end of verse 22, Moses gets married, has a son, and there's a little glimpse here that Moses might be giving up when he names his son a stranger there. Gershom, "I'm a stranger. I came out of Egypt to lead my people back to their land. And for 40 years, I'm still a stranger." He spent 40 years away from home, another 40 years away from home. And here's Moses at the age of 80. Now, before we pick up and continue, I want to point out just a bit of what we could accurately call, I think, irony that has developed thus far in the passage. From this perspective, Pharaoh is very intent on getting rid of boys. That's his fear. His fear is primarily one of military might. It's possible that he assumes if he lets the girls grow up, they're going to just marry in and blend in with the Egyptians. But notice in the story up until this point how God has used women and girls. You remember who defied the king's orders concerning killing the baby boys as midwives? It was women. Boys weren't Pharaoh's problem in that situation. What about Levi's daughter, Jochebed, Moses' mom? It wasn't a man who was the problem there. It was Jochebed, believing God and not fearing the king, who secured a basket, covered it with pitch and tar, and put Moses in the reed. Not only that, it was a little girl named Miriam, Moses' older sister, who's sitting by, waiting for everything to play out so that she can play her all-important part of suggesting that she go find some obscure Hebrew woman to raise Moses. Again, it's not a baby boy that's Pharaoh's problem. And then, it's not a boy or a son, but Pharaoh's daughter herself that poses the great problem to Pharaoh when she comes down to bathe in the Nile and she sees the little boy and she has compassion and pity on him. The Pharaoh's daughter defies her father, the king. And then when Moses is out, now a shepherd, wandering down to Midian on his way to being a shepherd, it's Jethro's daughters. Again, it's quite ironic that the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, is worried about getting rid of all the boys. And here it is girls, ladies, who are crucial in playing an all-important part in the what God is orchestrating concerning his people. It wasn't the sons alone that posed a threat to Pharaoh. Here's Pharaoh's primary problem. He was absolutely unaware who he was dealing with. He was clueless that he was dealing with God, and that God had the ability to use anything and anyone he wanted in any way he wanted. The people of Israel have found no hope thus far in their lineage. Joseph has died and the whole generation with him. The people of Israel, the people of God, have found no hope in human leadership. In fact, when a new king arrives on the scene, he didn't know Joseph and things got worse. The people of Israel have received no benefit whatsoever because of the increased suffering in their life. Suffering has not equaled sanctification for them. Not only that, this deliverer up until this point has provided them only empty hope. There's no hope for them in a mere man like Moses. So as a result of them putting hope in lineage or leadership or suffering or a mere man, they're finally, it appears, at this point in the story, at the end of all of these false hopes. And it came about in the course of those many days, verse 23, that the king of Egypt died. And you think, okay, here it is, new leadership. That's really going to help them this time. And the sons of Israel sighed. No change again. There's no real hope in that. They sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. The death of a great dynasty, followed by dark days of oppression, infanticide, and gender selective genocide. The dawn of a deliverer in Moses that ends up being a false dawn or deliverance delayed for some time, has finally resulted in desperate desires within the people of God. They sighed. They groaned. They shrieked. Their neediness. They cried out to God, lifting their voices for help. And God heard their groaning. He heard them. And not only did he hear them, but he remembered his covenant with them. Not that he had forgotten, but he remembered it afresh and began acting again in that covenant towards his people, seeing his children, not with his all-seeing eyes, but as the apple of his eye, intent to do them good, taking notice of them, not in the peripheral, but being intimately acquainted with them again and dwelling with them. And we'll see a more full answer to this in the next chapter. But if you'll fast forward to chapter 3, verse 7, you'll see God's answer spelled out for us. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. And I've given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I'm aware of their sufferings. So I've come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians. Verse 9, Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I've seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. You have to think, at this point in the lives of the people of God, that they have to be pleased to hear from their God that he's taken notice of them. After 400 years of miserable bondage, underneath terrible oppression, living through horrific genocide, the only hope in the land, the one who was born, who was allowed to live in Moses, has turned to a disappointment because of the delay. The days are dark, and the only deliverance on the horizon seems to be but a dream. But then verse 23 happens. They sighed, they groaned, they shrieked, they cried out to God, and he heard them. What will it take for us? Do we not live in a world ravaged by sin? Are we not surrounded with the bondage of this world? Are we not aware of the genocide happening at astronomical rates all around us? Especially right around us. Have we not found out by experience that the days are indeed dark? And deliverance seems like such a long way off. Foggy. Should we not be at the end? Have we not reached the end of our attempts to bring about change in our own strength? By outpopulating the enemy, or outwitting them in our dealings with them, or politically out-strategizing them. What will it take for us to, like the people of God here, sigh and groan and cry out to God until he hears us? And this is what we really need. For him to hear us and to remember his covenant with us that he's made with the Son of his love who sits at his right hand, to see us in our affliction, to take intentional notice of us, to intimately acquaint himself with us again, for us to be dissatisfied with the mere omnipresence or the idea that God is everywhere, and to long for his cultivated manifest presence, that we would live in that reality day in, day out, moment by moment. In these first couple of chapters, it's obvious that there's absolutely no hope in any type of multi-generational strategy for us. Joseph died and the whole generation with him. That's a hopeless approach. There's no hope in a different national ruler. What a ridiculous notion. A new ruler shows up on the scene and says, Joseph who? I don't know him. In chapter 2, verse 23, again, another king, same old results. And the people sigh and groan. When will that be our approach? There's no lasting hope in a mere great human leader, even like Moses. We see him taking matters into his own hands, falling on his face, delaying the rescue of the people for once 40 years and then another 40. And then Moses ends up blowing it again by not leading them out into Canaan and across the Jordan. But it doesn't have to be that way for us. We have the wonderful privilege of learning from these mistakes, like Paul encourages the church in Corinth to do, to learn from their terrible mistakes and to not look to anything other than God himself to be our great deliverer. We need nothing more than for him to hear us and to look towards us, to take notice of us, and to remember his covenant that he's made with his son, which is to do you good, both you and your children, all the days of your life. There's no hope in any kind of strategy. Not political, not religious, not even Christianized. There's no hope of a different national ruler or a great human leader. But there's immense hope in God. There's immense hope in him orchestrating all things in our lives so that we might cry out to him, that we might sigh and groan for rescue in him. May God give us grace to see that he has done just that. That he has orchestrated every event in your life up until this point. When Paul's preaching at Mars Hill in Acts 17, he says just that. That God has determined the boundaries of your habitation and the times in which you live in order that you might grope for him, long for him, and find him. And these are finding times. Why not seek him with all your heart? So that he will indeed be found by you. Let's ask the Lord to make these truths real in us.